Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 598, titled Interview with Kevin Coogan about Francis Parker Yockey. This has been recorded on May 20th of the year 2007. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. For those who may have missed side one, Francis Parker Yockey was a fascist activist and for much of his life, a Nazi spy before, during, and after World War II. But more than that, and far more importantly, he was an ideological fount of fascism and one whose ideas have exerted a tremendous influence on the contemporary fascist and right-wing political landscape, in spite of the fact that most people have never heard of the name Francis Parker Yockey. Kevin, welcome back once again.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we resume with maybe an encapsulation of the dynamic that you were talking about at the end of side one, namely the influence of Oswald Spengler and his decline of the West on Yockey, and how that in turn influenced Yockey to posit his concept of the Imperium.
Sure. As I was saying before, Spengler had seen the decline of the West as almost inevitable, and Spengler had argued that it could possibly be reversed for a brief period by what he called the rise of Caesarism, by which he meant a strongman government. And in many ways, decline of the West is fascinating when you think that that's sort of what happened in Europe. I mean, you had Mussolini first and then Hitler in 1933. And remember, Spengler's writing in 1918, 1919. But when Germany failed, the question for people like Yockey was that they didn't want to give up. They were still committed to this vision. And so Yockey tried to sort of reframe Spengler's argument to say, no, basically Spengler was wrong, and that the period of failure of Hitler, when Hitler was defeated, when Nazism was defeated, was really simply a kind of an overture to a higher form of fascism, and that the limitations of Hitlerism was that it was, in a certain sense, too biological, and that we needed this new idea of not just Germany as the dominating power, but Europe as a whole. So basically, I would say that he sort of fetishized this concept of a united Europe, which had been developing already, as I indicated earlier, in occupation policy of certain elements of the SS, and projected this as a model for the post-war, for a post-war revival of fascism. In other words, after the defeat, people were looking around for what new idea do you have to develop to sort of advance the movement when all the old shibboleths had been literally destroyed.
Germany
was in ruins.
Right. We're talking about defeat of Nazi Germany
right.
here, and from
right.
Yockey's standpoint, how to revive fascism
right.
in Germany.
Okay. Right.
Right.
And you couldn't. And in other words, what he was saying is that you couldn't revive it on simple. You couldn't repeat the same process over again. You had to develop a newer, higher concept.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing. I mean, I would like to say that Yockey was extremely influential, but I think it's more appropriate to say that Yockey's ideas reflected already existing influential ideas in the neo-fascist movement,
mm-hmm.
because you had after the war this attempt to build what's called sometimes an international of nationals. In other words, there was a real attempt to create almost a fascist kind of a Comintern, if you want to put it that way, of these various parties. And there's a brilliant book. I mean, a really brilliant book. Talk about a tough read. This is really a tough read by a man named Kurt Tauber, T-A-U-B-E-R, called Beyond Eagle and Swastika. And it's a two-volume book. The second volume, which is about 900 pages, is simply the footnotes to volume one. But Tauber does a really tremendous job in looking at the same period of 1945 to the early 60s in the attempt to revive post-war fascism. And he has a brilliant chapter on this whole question of fascism trying to develop a kind of an internationalism. And his chapter is called the International Nationals. So my point here is that Yockey was not simply sort of a grand theorist sitting in his apartment, but he was very much, because he was a political activist and a kind of a conspiratorial figure, he was very much moving in these circles. And so Imperium reflects that method of thinking.
So basically what you're saying is that what Yaki did was to focus and perhaps intensify certain trends within fascist thinking.
Definitely.
And trends that Yaki and obviously others of a similar mind saw as furthering the cause of fascism, perhaps enabling it to succeed, whereas it at least militarily had failed,
right,
and politically had failed,
right,
before.
Right, and redefining fascism for the post-war environment. And to me, that's why he's really interesting in an intellectual sense, in that it's almost as if, you know, after the Soviet Union collapses in 1991 and there's no more, you know, Bolshevism, or you know, what do people do next? There's just a tremendous vacuum, and this is even more true in 1945, you know, when Germany has been completely crushed.
And one of the things that I'd like to grapple with, Kevin, and maybe again, given the limited amount of time that we have, maybe we can only sort of give it a lick and a promise under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But with Yaki, and I think in the discussions of the differences in ideology and practical application of strategy within the SS that we touched on in Side 1, perhaps this gives us an opening or a vista on how to deal with what, certainly for me, and I suspect for some of the listeners, is a seeming contradiction. How does one get from Yaki's Imperium, basically a concept of European chauvinism and something that he believed very strongly, and yet some of the alliances that Yaki and others of a similar mind advocated were fascist alliances, or alliances between people who sought to restore or bring about the Imperium, with elements like the former Soviet Union or Communist China, elements of the Third World, including communist ones such as Cuba, and people within the Third World, Arabs, black Equatorial Africans, and others. And Yaki and others of a similar orientation saw each of these elements as perhaps playing a role in the realization of the grand strategy, and yet, to myself, and I suspect to an awful lot of the other listeners, to a lot of the listeners to the show, they're wondering, you know, how can this be? Because it seems like this is the ultimate, not only in strange bedfellows, but really in ideological opposites, at least superficially.
Right. This was a problem that I also had to grapple with. But I think the idea is, the best idea is actually pretty simple. They saw Europe almost as a third world country. In other words, After the war, they saw Europe very much in terms that the United States was dominating one half of Europe and the Soviet Union was dominating the other half of Europe. So Europe, their idea of Europe became not dissimilar to ideas of people in the Third World who also saw the United States trying to dominate, you know, whole sections of the Third World, the Russians dominating other sections of the Third World, and both parties, both the United States and Russia, in competition with each other, you know, over power in the Third World. Well, their concept was that, you know, this is not at all dissimilar to what's really going on in Europe, with the United States controlling, you know, Western Europe and the Russians controlling Eastern Europe. So their notion was not all that strange. It only seems strange to us, I think, because we still see Europe from the perspective of the United States and of Europe as sort of the great kind of cultural motherland of the United States. We don't see Europe in the way that they saw Europe as sort of occupied territory. So I think that's part of the problem. But the other aspect of it is that Yaki was extremely influenced, and some of his other co-thinkers were influenced by geopolitics and by people like General Haushofer, who was a very important military man and a German sort of strategic thinker who died in 1947. But Haushofer had a worldview that very much saw sort of power politics as based on sort of geography, race, culture, and other things. And he took a very broad outlook. And so, for example, Haushofer was very pro a German alliance with the Soviet Union in the 1920s, not because Haushofer was a communist. I mean, he loathed communism, but because Haushofer saw Russia as a sort of a natural geopolitical ally of Germany, in the sense that Russia could be a great kind of raw materials resource for Germany, and also Haushofer didn't want to fight, a two-front war.
Very quickly, Kevin, interjecting briefly, one of the things that you do in your book is to point out how Yaki and Haushofer and others who were of this viewpoint were really manifesting a traditional German Ostpolitik. And listeners to this show who would like to really pursue that in depth, I've now got, since we last spoke, Kevin, I've now got a bunch of old anti-fascist books and related volumes available for download for free on really compact Adobe PDF files. And one of them is T.H. Tetten's Germany Plots with the Kremlin, which, despite its sort of tabloid-like title, actually has a pretty good academic study of that traditional German Ostpolitik. Yep. So people who'd like to flesh themselves out on this particular aspect of what Kevin is talking about can do so at great length from the Spitfire website. Go ahead, Kevin.
I cite his book in my book.
Right.
But I mean, the one very simple way to think about it is that when Germany became a really unified the War of National Liberation, it was a war of national liberation against Napoleon's occupation of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the great turning point was when the Prussians, a Prussian general or two, went in alliance with the Tsar and joined the Tsar to kick out Napoleon in the period of, like, say, 1812, 1814. So this idea of Russia, of a Russian-German alliance, you know, this is very famous within the, you know, Prussian military tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of you know, when you look at history, the fascinating thing about history is that so many things kind of echo other events in the past. And if you don't have a developed historical perspective, you're always encountering things that just seem utterly bizarre. But the more you kind of dwell and think about these things and do research, very often you'll find not exactly recurring patterns, but you'll find many similarities.
One of the things that was interesting, and again, maybe this is too tall an order given the limited amount of time here. Certainly you wrote a formidable tome to explain a lot of these dynamics. But again, you've got Yaki. He's a European chauvinist. Now, you've explained how Yaki and many of his associates saw post-World War II Europe. They saw it as, in certain respects, constituting an occupied territory or a colonialized territory,
right,
not unlike third world territories, with the U.S. occupying the West and the Soviets occupying the East. Yet still, thinking of someone like Yaki, who was, in essence, at least up to a point, a European chauvinist, or saw the realization of the Imperium as the most desirable political goal, how is it that we see Yaki? We've talked about the former Soviet Union, but Yaki also saw alliances with the People's Republic of China and Castro's Cuba and elements in the Third World, both Arab nations and African nations and Asian nations, as also fitting into this dynamic. And I think That is an association that's going to, a lot of people are going to have a lot of problems simply understanding. And indeed, it was one of the things that I had to wrestle with too in coming to terms with your book.
Right?
Is there an easy way? How would you go about explaining how these associations manifest themselves?
Well, the easiest way is to say Yaki. The one of the outstanding traits of Yaki's personality was his absolute hatred for the United States. I mean, he loathed the United States. I mean, he hated the United States in about 100 different ways. And his approach was anything that would weaken or destroy the United States was you know, fine for him. And you'd even see that kind of way of thinking as almost a you know, potentially almost a proto-terroristic way of thinking. But he had such a rage against the United States that he saw the you know, other countries as potential allies, and to me that's not all, you know, to me that's not all that surprising that people think like that.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the enemy of my enemy.
Yes, the enemy of my enemy, but with a sense of just kind of burning hatred of America. I mean, Yaki was a person who would have loved to have seen the United States destroyed, even physically.
And he was an American citizen. We should not lose sight of that. We should always remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was not a European.
He was born in Michigan and raised in Chicago and went to Georgetown. And he got a law degree from Notre Dame in around 1940-41. But his personality was such that he had an extreme hatred of American culture. I mean, I discuss this in my book, mm-hmm. his hatred of jazz, his hatred of kind of popular culture, his hatred of popular movies. He just saw the United States, as many fascists did in Europe, he saw the United States as kind of a great polluter of culture. Yaki was a great classical piano player and had very strong identification with sort of high classical culture, and he viewed the United States with just complete contempt. And this is not unheard of in European intellectual circles, either then or today, for that matter.
So in other words, Kevin, perhaps echoing a contemporary idiom, those people in Europe, European and American reactionary circles, who saw America as the great Satan, could potentially find allies among other elements around the world in what we now call the third world and elsewhere, who took that same attitude.
But also, I think the other problem that people have to realize is that I think the real contradiction in most people's minds is that, well, the Nazis were racist. They hated all other inferior people who had impure blood. Why would the Nazis have any dealing with such creatures whom they despised and made no secret of their despising them?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that if you look at German policy, of Nazi policy, for example, in the Middle East, and I discussed this with my section on François Junot, who had been a very important figure in the post-war period of post-war Nazism, but also played a role in the 1930s. The fact is that German intelligence was extraordinarily active throughout the Arab world against British and French colonialism, and you can't understand why Hitler would meet the Grand Mufti if you think that Hitler simply thought that the Arabs were racially inferior. The reality is that the Germans had foreign policy. They had foreign policy objectives, and they pursued foreign policy objectives in many different places. Most notably, in my case, because Yaki was in the Middle East and lived in Egypt, in the Middle East. And when you come across these people, the Germans are very active in. First, I should say that this whole policy, you can trace this policy back to the late 1800s, when Germany becomes the primary supporter of the Ottoman Empire. And then you can see German policy trying to work against British and French colonial policy. And you can also see it, as I point out in my book, in even with China, because Hayamar Schacht, who was at one point Hitler's finance minister, after the war, Schacht goes in 57 to China and tries to work out economic deals with the Chinese. Now, the Chinese are, Chinese communism in 1957 is pretty extreme. So this idea that somehow this sort of simple-minded idea of Germans or Nazi policy as simply being racially dogmatic in a certain sense is simply not true.
One of the things that's interesting too, Kevin, if you could, one of the things you talk about in your book, and that is how Yaki's anti-Semitism factored into some of the political dynamics and alliances that he envisioned. In particular, he was very active in the early 50s, at least ideologically active, on behalf of Stalin's Soviet Union, which he saw as a potential ally of the fascists. If you could develop that a little bit for us.
Well, the first thing I should point out is that one of Yaki's historical deeds of importance, to put it that way, is that he was very early involved in trying to discredit the whole Nuremberg trial process. Yaki had been a post-war attorney. He was based in Wiesbaden for war crimes investigations of sort of secondary or tertiary figures in the German military, and he began supplying documents to various members of the defense team of the Nazis, the defense lawyers who were defending the Nazis, to try and discredit the entire Nuremberg process, and so he is probably the first American. He's either the first or the second American. I still haven't made up my mind. Who began writing Holocaust denial literature. And if you look at Imperium, there's a whole section at the end of Imperium where he denies the Holocaust. Now this is really early. I mean, as I say, the Imperium comes out in 1948. So his link to people like Cardo and the IHR. He really is a precursor in that sense to this attempt to deny the existence of the Holocaust, or to minimize the existence of the Holocaust. But his promotion of anti-Semitism was part of an attempt to link the Third World and the Arabs in particular against the United States. And it also, and the same idea of anti-Semitism he used to try and justify supporting Joseph Stalin in 1952. And Yaki wrote a pamphlet, which I discuss in my book, called Why Are They Hanging the Jews in Prague?
Mm-hmm.
And what that is about is in 1952 there was the trial of a man named Rudolf Slansky, who had been a leading member of the Czech Communist Party. And Slansky and I think 10 other Czech communists were brought to trial and accused of being secret agents of the British Secret Service, the American Secret Service, and the American Jewish Committee and the Zionist Lobby. And they were, you know, convicted in a show trial and then executed. And this was part of Stalin's late campaign when Stalin went on a kind of a rampage against what he called cosmopolitans, by which he really meant Jews. And it's part of Stalin's, part of his paranoia that this happened. But Yaki saw this as a great opening to justify opening up relations between the far right and Russia by arguing that now Stalin had been a guy who rejected the Bolshevism, which you know, Bolshevism was supposed to be a Jewish Zionist plot, but Stalin had come along and sort of removed Bolshevism and had promoted healthy Russian nationalism. And when Yaki wrote this, this was also very important in the arguments of Fred Weiss. I mean, Fred Weiss wrote a lot about this idea that Russia was now a new state under Stalin, which could almost be a model to work in alliance with Germany.
Fred Weiss, by the way, was the German fifth columnist who was associated with the American, the National Renaissance
Correct.
Party and James Madol,
Correct.
About whom we spoke in Side 1 for
exactly.
people who might have just
yep.
tuned in. Proceed,
yep. exactly.
Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can find, it's just fascinating, in the 1950s, you can find writings by Fred Weiss that could almost be out of the Daily Worker or some Communist Party publication, where he's praising the Russian developments in Siberia, their new technological advances. He praises the Sputnik and claims that the launch of the Sputnik and Soviet control of space means the downfall of the United States. And yet he's the guy who is running around with Yaki. And also recall, I'm not recalling because I haven't mentioned it, but in this period, there's a period in the mid-1950s where the FBI becomes convinced that Yaki has spent some time actually in Eastern Europe. And the FBI launches probes to try and determine, if Yaki had crossed over, the Berlin, from West Berlin to East Berlin. And I give evidence in my book, because partly I declassified the FBI files, but also other evidence, that there's reason to believe that, in fact, Yaki did spend some time in the East Bloc.
A couple of things, Kevin. We're down to just the last few minutes
sure.
of the interview. Some other manifestations of some of the political strange bedfellows that Yaki, with whom he traveled and whose an alliance with which he advocated. Is it possible to give us a succinct encapsulation of the fascist third position, and how does this relate, or the third position per se, how does this relate to some of the dynamics that we've already talked about?
Well, generally mean by the third position is this same kind of idea of neither with the United States or with the Russians. And in fascism, the third position is important because, as we all know, the United States after the war greatly tried to assimilate various Nazis, famously the network of General Galen, and to really put them on the American payroll, because the Americans saw the Nazis or certain elements of the Nazis as being more anti-communist than more anti-American. And so this meant that in the intelligence services and in the militaries in the 1950s, there were a lot of, really unreformed Nazis who had been given kind of a free pass by American intelligence because American intelligence needed them as sort of a bulwark against a potential communist invasion. And this also involves, things like the Gladio network. I mean, the Gladio network, which was this sort of stay-behind network in throughout Europe, incorporated many people from the far right. A lot of people in Gladio were not Nazis. Actually, there were many different kinds of people in Gladio, but there were significantly really far right figures in Gladio. And so the third position was, in a certain sense, an attempt by elements within fascism itself to say, hey, we don't want to be sort of on the American payroll. And again, to promote this sort of neutralist viewpoint in alliance with the thinking of people like Yaki. And so the third position And also, I should also say that the third position was also a reaction within fascism against more conventional fascist groups, for example, Italy's MSI, which at a certain point abandoned the radical road and became really a parliamentary party. And so the third position people drew strength from the arguments of people like Otto Strasser, who was a sort of a radical kind of half-Nazi, half-socialist from the 1920s, and also from Mussolini, particularly the period in Italy of the Salo Republic, when Mussolini, after Mussolini returned from Germany, Mussolini returned to kind of his radical socialist roots in the Salo Republic and began promoting a kind of a left fascism. And so with so Strasserism is a kind of a left fascism, and the Salo Republic is a kind of left fascism. And this idea inspired what is really what we would call today the third position.
Alrighty, and Kevin, we're down to the last couple of minutes here.
Sure.
You spend a whole appendix on François Genoux, and I've taken the liberty of putting much of that chapter on Genoux into the description for the Record 453. So people whose interest has been whetted can go to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and get an overview of François Genoux, a person who was a prime operative of Nazi Germany and who unites many of these strange bedfellows for a period of decades and runs right on out through the milieu, as you've written about in some of your essays on Al-Taqwa and Ahmed Huber. He touches base with people whose names crop up in the investigation of September 11th.
Well, you know, I interviewed François Genoux in Geneva in, in Luzerne in 86. Martin Lee, who is also the author of a good book called The Beast Reawakens, which is another book about fascism in the post-war period, Martin Lee and I interviewed Genoux for an article on for Mother Jones, which was one of the very early articles in this whole question of kind of third position fascism. And when I was in Bern interviewing Ahmed Huber from the Al-Taqwa Network, Huber talked about Genoux and talked about his great friendship with Genoux and how they would meet every Thursday for many years to discuss politics and other matters. So Genoux is an absolutely fascinating character, and I should say that there are now two books on Genoux in French, one by a man named Carl Lasky and another guy by a man named Pierre Pian, on Genoux and Genoux's relations, for example, with people like Carlos the Jackal, who Genoux knew and was a friend of. And really, Genoux is a remarkable figure. And if you want to get over this idea that somehow, you know, Nazis can't talk with people of color or Arabs, I mean, just look at Genoux's history.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, I think that some of the political strange bedfellows that are evident throughout your formidable tome, those types of alliances are things that people should look at very closely and see if they don't see some corresponding relationships beginning to develop on the contemporary political landscape. We have been speaking with Kevin Coogan. Kevin, before we wrap here, tell us briefly about the book, where to get it, what
sure.
it is.
It's A Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. It was published in 1999 by Autana Media, which is actually a Brooklyn-based house. And you can get it either through the Autana Media website, or you can get it at Amazon.com, or you can ask a library to order it.
Yep. And again, as I've said before, and this is not an act of currying favor, one of the most important books ever written about international fascism, and also one of the toughest reads, but very much worth the effort. We've been visiting with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in soft cover by Autano Media, and also the author of a number of articles dealing with Ahmed Huber and the Bank Al-Taqwa milieu. Kevin, thanks so much for visiting with us. We'll do this again some point in the future.
Hey, thank you.
And for Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 2 of For the Record program number 598 being recorded on May 20th of 2007. Thanks for listening.